Now in the case of United States against Clark.
May it please the Court, Chad Clamage on behalf of Defendant Appellant Osmond Clark. If Mr. Clark's crack sentence for his crack convictions were within the current guidelines range, he would be a free man today living in Jamaica. Without acknowledging that Mr. Clark is serving a substantially above guideline sentence, and without even recognizing that Mr. Clark will be deported to Jamaica immediately upon his release, the District Court denied Mr. Clark's Section 3582 motion for a sentence reduction. It did so by rubber stamping a form order with a two-sentence, patently inapplicable rationale that a probation officer had supplied ex parte.
Why do you say it's patently inapplicable?
The District Court found that Mr. Clark poses a danger to the community if he is released. Mr. Clark never will be released into the United States. He will be deported to Jamaica.
Now, that's a terrible, terrible argument. Terrible argument. First of all, he may come back illegally. But second of all, what would it do for the foreign relations of the United States if we said, you know, we have this very dangerous criminal. He's a murderer and so on. We're sending him to your country because that'll be your problem, right? That would be ridiculous.
The District Court in this case.
Otherwise, the nature of your argument is one in which every alien must be sentenced to the statutory minimum sentence, which usually means immediate release, so he can go home and wreak havoc there. The only legitimate concern of the United States is crime in the United States. That's never been the law. It's never been close to the law.
Even if that's not the law, Your Honor, I think it's assuming far too much to think that the District Court in this case thought that Mr. Clark would be deported to Jamaica, or thought that it was protecting Jamaica from Mr. Clark. There's no indication in the record that the District Court considered Clark's deportability. And at the very least, it was a question that the District Court should have considered.
I don't think she should have. I don't think she should have.
Right. The way in which the retroactive process works, it's not a complete resentencing. You're proceeding as if this were a total resentencing from the beginning. The judge is supposed to consider everything the judge would have taken into account at the beginning. The only thing the judge is supposed to respond to is a change in the guideline. And here we have a change in the guideline, and the judge says, I don't care. Well, that's seems to me the way this process allows a judge to behave.
I think this question is a question of first impression in this court. The court has never considered the fact that above-guideline sentence.
The Supreme Court held in Dillon that the judge not only doesn't but shouldn't go through the whole process that the judge would go through in an original sentencing proceeding. And that's what you're accusing the judge of not doing. I suppose my technical question is, how is your position compatible with Dillon?
Our position is compatible with Dillon because in Dillon the Supreme Court held that a district court must consider the applicable policy statements of the Sentencing Commission and may not treat the sentencing guidelines range or the sentencing range as a guidelines sentence and depart below that. Our case is entirely consistent with Dillon because here we have a substantially above guideline sentence, and all we're asking for is a within the guideline sentence.
Now, look, you are making arguments that were, if valid at all, equally applicable at the original sentencing. And you're essentially saying that the judge has to go through the whole process and consider all the things that would have been considered at the original sentence. I read Dillon to say that that's not how this works. Now, why is that understanding of Dillon wrong?
To begin with, the judge in this case imposed the lowest sentence that was possible at that time. The circumstances have changed over the last 14 years, and there's no indication that the district court in this case took the Sentencing Commission or Congress's change in sentencing policy for crack offenses into account.
I asked you a question about the reasoning of the Supreme Court in Dillon. Your answer does not seem to be related to the reasoning of the Supreme Court in Dillon.
The reasoning in the Supreme Court in Dillon, as I read the case, was that a district court may not impose a below-guideline sentence and disregard what the Sentencing Commission is saying in the applicable policy statement. We're not asking
that's hardly all the Supreme Court said in Dillon.
We're not asking anything that was inconsistent with the Sentencing Commission's applicable policy statement. There's another issue that I'd also like to address, which is that the probation officer filed an ex parte letter that addressed adjudicatory facts that were in dispute that improperly stated that the government opposed Mr. Clark's Section 3582 motion, that opined that Mr. Clark's motion should be denied, and that gave the district court the very form order that the district court entered when denying Mr. Clark's motion. Now, Neal holds that Mr. Clark was entitled to notice of the probation officer's ex parte letter. He did not receive that notice in this case, and we think that that is a reason to, at the very least, vacate the district court's order and return the case to the district court so that Mr. Clark can develop a record regarding the probation officer's ex parte filings and respond to them because
if you look at this form order, which you don't like, well, I think it looks pretty good, actually. She checked number 3. You said she just added 2 sentences. It's true. She just added 2 sentences. She checked number 3, which says, defendant is eligible for reduction, but the court has determined such a reduction is not appropriate because of the nature and seriousness of the danger to any person or the community that may be posed by a reduction sentence. And why doesn't that cover the waterfront? Because the concern, obviously, is that if he and his companion in crime had discovered the wire on the informant, he would have killed him. That's obviously what worries her. That's what makes her think he's very dangerous, and that's what she checks, and that's perfectly appropriate. It really just leaves you with a deportation argument.
It leaves us with the deportation argument. It leaves us with the fact that the district court did not consider that Mr. Clark is serving a substantially above guideline sentence. And it still leaves us with the improper ex parte
letter. I said the defendant is eligible for a reduction. She knew that.
She knew he was eligible, but eligible does not mean that he's serving a substantially above guideline sentence. And in any event, that doesn't take into account the fact that the probation officer supplied an ex parte letter that Mr. Clark should have had notice about and should have had an opportunity to respond to. I see I'm in my rebuttal.
Wasn't she advised what his new guidelines range was?
In Mr. Clark's motion, yes, she was.
Yeah.
And then
so
the probation officer disagreed with that.
She was giving an above-guideline sentence.
It's not clear that she knew
or
that.
Or she was retaining, or that the sentence was still above guidelines.
There's no indication when you read the district court's order that she understood that, and we think that that was a problem.
No, I don't think so.
It seems rather odd. She knew what sentence Clark is serving. You agree with that? She knew what the new guideline range was. Even a judge can engage in addition and subtraction. You can see that one is higher than the other.
We're asking for a heightened justification requirement. I see that the court doesn't believe that one is necessary, but that still leaves the question of the ex parte improper communication in this case, and I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Certainly, Mr. Clamage. Mr. Minkler.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, the counsel, Josh Minkler, appearing on behalf of the United States of America. The district court did not abuse its discretion in denying Mr. Clark's 3582 motion. The singularly most important part of this record is the assessment of the danger that would be posed by Clark should he be released from prison early. This is so significant that 2 separate district court judges noticed it. And this court, on the first appeal of his 3582 denial, agreed with it. The most important factor here is protection of the public. And these are the words of the court. The danger he poses plays a greater role than the drug quantity for which Clark was held accountable. The essential facts which support that finding are not in dispute. He engaged three times while armed in drug trafficking. He was the muscle for each of those drug transactions. He used the firearm to protect the gun and the money, and on the final drug transaction displayed the weapon while the informant was searched for a wire. That increases the danger. But let's get to the meat of this discussion. The district court denied Clark's motion, and the result of that denial was an above-guideline sentence. So the issue this court asked us to address was that in this particular case, do we need to provide additional justification for Clark's sentence?
Well, the principal reason why we're here is because we were interested in mootness.
I understand that, Your Honor. And the court has articulated a reason why mootness would be a proper issue. There is certainly case law that would support that. Nonetheless, it is the Department of Justice's position that this is an aggregate sentence of 211 months, and Mr. Clark is eligible for a sentence reduction that was properly denied by the district court.
There was some reflection, attempt to, about his current situation, lots of stuff he did in prison and proved and all that sort of thing. Are we confined to the original condition at sentencing, the original sentencing? Or all the, does this additional stuff have any reason to concern some mitigation?
His additional behavior in prison, I believe, is relevant. And if you would look at the court's form order, which has been used quite often, I think it is acceptable, and that is one of the factors that can be determined. For instance, the court has determined the post-sentencing conduct demonstrates the defendant may pose a danger to the community if he did something while in prison.
Well, they try to say all the good things he did.
Well, certainly, Judge, and that is something that the court may consider. That was something that obviously counsel for the federal public defender who filed this motion attached that information to the motion. That motion was given to Judge Barker. There is nothing in this record that shows that she did not consider it. Certainly, though, this record shows the individual is a danger to the public, and it's not an abuse of discretion to deny that motion because he is a danger to the public. I do want to briefly address Mr. Clamage's claim that Judge Barker rubber-stamped a secret letter, ex parte letter. That is not what occurred in this case. There is certainly a policy and procedure as to how all the 3582 motions are handled in the Southern District of Indiana. The federal public defender has been appointed to handle all of them since 2008. They are well familiar with the policy and the orders set by the court. I'm not sure why he refers to it as a secret ex parte letter. The court in its order refers to it as a worksheet assessment and information. The court does order that information filed under seal. I think that's sort of an unfortunate term. It's not under seal, but it is restricted access. It is available upon request to counsel for the parties. Ms. Scott did not object to this form worksheet assessment being filed. I understand Mr. Clamage is upset about the probation officer's recommendation in that what I call a worksheet or assessment that the motion should be denied, but that is not unusual for a probation officer to provide a district court judge of the probation officer's opinion as to the merits of a particular sentence. That is done in our district under local rule, and it has been approved by this court. So there is no secret star chamber process here. It has been a process that's been done, and in my opinion, done well since 2008, that has resulted in many defendants on crack cocaine cases being let out of prison. The nonviolent defendants who, in the U.S. Attorney's judgment, the court's judgment, because we do agree to quite a few of these, do not present a danger to the public. But Mr. Clark is not one of those defendants. We believe, as Judge Hamilton did in 2008 and as Judge Barker did again in 2011, that he does represent a danger to the public, and so the motion was properly denied. And unless the court has further questions, I would just request that this court affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Anything further, Mr. Clement?
This court held in Marion that district courts should at least briefly address significant events that happen after a defendant has been sentenced. And the government now concedes that that conduct is relevant. The government somehow reads the form order that the district court entered in this case to somehow mention Mr. Clark's prison conduct. I can't see how that's a possible reading of the order. But in any event, the government also argues that Mr. Clark's post-sentencing conduct suggests that he poses a danger to the community. The government takes the facts from that only from the ex parte letter that the probation officer had supplied to the district court, in a sense doubling down on the ex parte letter. The government argues that the only thing that we dispute about the ex parte letter is that it recommended that Mr. Clark's sentence be denied, and I don't think that's true. I think that it shouldn't have stated that there were four acts of misconduct while in prison. Mr. Clark did not have an opportunity to develop a record regarding those acts, and it should not have mentioned that the government opposed Mr. Clark's motion. If the government wanted to oppose Mr. Clark's motion, it should have done so in open court when Mr. Clark has an opportunity to respond. Finally, even taking at face value the assertions against Mr. Clark regarding the four acts of misconduct, none of them involved violent behavior. This is the last 14 years of Mr. Clark's life in which there are no instances of violence. We think that that undermines the district court's conclusion that he poses a danger to the community, and it should have been at least considered, as this court requires in Marion. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The court, Mr. Clement, appreciates your willingness and that of your law firm to accept the appointment and your assistance to the court as well as your firm. The case is taken.